And I'm going to start with a real simple question for all three of you.
What is time? Anderson is one of those directors who either very rarely or doesn't at all miscast people.
I love a tape projection.
Hey, welcome to Taking It Down, the TV and streaming podcast from the Alabama Take. We give thoughts that range from complex to simple, from analytical to basic about shows and movies on TV. I'm Blaine Duncan, editor-in-chief of the website The Alabama Take. I've always enjoyed determining why I like and dislike things, and I have a little bit of a side hustle as an English teacher, so hopefully that lends itself to our busy listeners who want some insight. It's great for listeners that it's not just me breaking down what you want to know. It's Adam Morrow, our erudite touring and studio musician who keeps up with fine literature, Donovan Reinwald, who specializes in media at a New England college and loves film, old books, and more. And Natalie Morrow. She's the first person to go to about fantasy, sci-fi, comics, trashy reality TV, and Beyonce's music. We're here for lovers of television who are just too busy for anything more than the series or movie itself, or maybe for the person who just does not want the typical critic or Hollywood adjacent analysis. Plus, like a lot of Alabama Take productions, we're high quality. We actually think. Let's get into the show. We're here this week with Donovan, Adam and Natalie, of course, our usual crew, though Donovan's returning, our returning champion. We're going to kick things off by telling you, if you don't watch the YouTube video version, then there's extra talk on there, extra analysis of a show or two. This week it was, what are we going to do individually for October or Halloween? It was good talk, as well as some challenge talk. We decided to put that in the extra rather than talk about it in the audio. And in YouTube, it is timestamped. Far as I know, as the host, you can click on it and it'll take you to that segment so that you can skip around if you want. It should be clickable, much like the audio is in, say, I think Spotify and a couple other podcast apps. Elsewhere, you just have to look at the timestamps in the notes and scroll to the point where you want to hear. Thanks for listening. Here we are. The second season of Loki is upon us. It started on Disney Plus this week. Set of episodes that's going to run six long for 6 weeks. There's a good chance we'll be analyzing and talking about what goes on with it off and on. The show, of course, stars the note-perfect Tom Hiddleston, I would say. Sophia De Martino as his variant, his Loki variant, her name's Sylvie. Owen Wilson's back as Morbius, and at some point, we're supposed to see Jonathan Majors beyond just his statue. He's some version of Kang. We'll spoil this first episode this week, so let's jump into this river of time. And I'm going to start with a real simple question for all three of you. What is time?
It's really interesting that you asked that, because my college just got access to these books from Oxford University Press called Very Short Introductions. And they're all a very short introduction on a topic. And one of them is time. And what I've discovered from it is that I don't know anything about it.
But you read it?
Yeah, it was great. Time is weird.
It's so weird. It's so weird. Did y'all think about time during this episode?
How did Adam not immediately just say a flat circle? Are you okay?
Deep concentration.
Check the man's temperature.
The time thing is, you know, I should have watched a recap for starting this episode, because
he just immediately picked up his phone. He's like, I don't know what's happening.
It was tough. Just a recap. Yeah, let's do a quick recap. So they went to, quote, the end of time with the help of some more Loki variants, and it was a thunderstorm apocalyptic area. They get into a building and run across He Who Remains, which apparently is a variant of Kang who's got a lot of power. They decide we need to fight him, and Sylvie actually says we should kill him. Loki says no, we shouldn't, that could mess something up. She kicks him through a door, and that's exactly where this one picks up. The door she kicked him through lands him back at TVA in the past, before he had ever appeared. Is that about right?
That's right.
Yeah. Sounds about fair.
Thanks. I noted Disney did something different with this one, and its release. it's almost a throwback of television rather than streaming, like a cable kind of thing. You couldn't watch it until 8 p.m. on the dot on Thursday evening.
Which I appreciated very much, because last year it was 12:01 a.m. and spoilers were on in the headlines of news articles about it. So annoying.
And you're not even that spoiler averse. You're very tempered when it comes to spoilers, whereas I get furious.
And but like just knowing that they're not even trying to hide it is just like, as a person, you just know that that's so annoying to most people on the planet.
It's infuriating. But that's the way they're doing all their shows up until this one. Any clues on that strategy? Have y'all ran across any articles that say they've decided to do it on the dot?
No clue.
Man. Yeah, I mean, I just assumed it was just going to be playing on Thursday at any time. So I sit down at 7:30 and I was like, oh, wait, I've got to kill 30 minutes. So thank you, Wrexham. Mm.
Perfect.
Yeah. The first season was probably one of the better shows produced by Disney and done. And I mean all shows by Disney Plus, with maybe the exception of Andor. I would put Andor above it. And this one picks right up, I think. So let's talk about the episode as an episode itself. I honestly found myself a little less concerned with the events of the episode and trying to keep up. Maybe because they were purposefully confusing to replicate a sense of insanity that was happening on screen. But I was also way more plugged into the characters, especially Morbius, Loki, and this new character of OB, who's played by Kehui Kwan from Everything Everywhere All at Once and well beyond that. So I chalked this up to, they have the perfect mix of personalities and performances going in this show. And it's going to propel it into some really good things, even if the script gets a little stupid.
I think I'd agree with that, because I found myself also, like, it was, there were this episode, it had stakes, sort of, but there were kind of no stakes, right? Like, the show's called Loki. He's not going to disappear, you know, one episode into the, so it was, you know, it was like, it was a lot of kind of excuse for, like, a space running around and space shouting. Tom Hiddleston is, as you said, pitch perfect. Like, he and Owen Wilson seem to have good chemistry. I think Owen Wilson made some really good points about the quality of life without skin.
Excellent points there.
I thought that was a good point.
I like that you're just calling him Owen Wilson.
So yeah, I think I was more like you, Blaine.
Put Owen Wilson with the right person, and he just is one of the most enjoyable actors to have. If you put him with the right person, Hiddleston and Wilson, they vibe off each other so well. Because Hiddleston is playing serious and, oh my God, I'm in a rush and I'm about to have a heart attack. We've got to fix this. And Wilson's more obviously laid back. He does that better than anyone. And the show hinges on their chemistry. Very wise to make sure neither of them, you know, got killed last season. And then Kehui Kwan comes in and he doesn't miss a beat. He's just right there with them. Funny. Dropping one-liners. Yeah. It was just a fun show, I thought. You hated it?
No. I mean, it was, like y'all said, I mean, this episode, it was more, we just got to see our old pals being pals again, and that's fun. Mm-hmm. But the story itself, I mean, nothing really happened. The stakes of him getting stuck,
I would say, it's
or
all
whatever.
Set. Oop,
it
I'm
didn't.
Sorry.
It was just all resolved, like the one big, like, I don't know, cliffhanger. Wasn't a cliffhanger. And it got resolved so fast. I was like, oh, that was pointless. But it was still fun to watch.
It didn't play for y'all like a Doctor Who episode?
No.
I thought y'all might enjoy that feel of, we've got this conflict, we're going to fix it. But it's also a little bit bigger narrative happening.
Have you ever seen a Doctor Who episode?
Years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, when I was a kid. The 70s one where they were in the... I thought it was well done overall. It created this dizzying atmosphere with its camera work, twisting frequently, you know, turning on its axis. And I find it a plus, too, that I get transfixed by the set It's got this 70s era Disney World aesthetic. It's like if someone from 1975 envisioned what the future of space travel was going to look like with some mixed NASA relics involved. If you ever go to Disney World, you see this everywhere, and it's just fun to be near, I think. And, you know, it is, this is one small part of a larger narrative, and the stakes weren't huge because you knew it was going to get fixed. But at the same time, I did like that the conflict was singular and kind of self-contained. Loki was rescued from the time slipping. All is okay for now.
So. I guess it was the fact that I think the stakes of the problem didn't match the energy of the show, of this episode. Because it was really high energy and it was like kind of manic, which made it fun to watch, but I think that made the conflict kind of fall flat to me.
A lot of the Marvel shows, their first episode is just so much table setting. And, and I was just happy this wasn't.
I would say this one was all set up, but I don't think it was, I don't know what you're setting up for. So I would actually agree with you, Blaine, but not in a plus way for them.
Loki finally does see Sylvie face-to-face toward the end, but there's a telephone ringing. There's some mystery on who's on the end of that telephone. The one gripe I do have about the show, or maybe Marvel, it's a bit frustrating to figure out, like, is this not multiverse? This is just different timeline stuff. Does that mean there could be different timelines for each multiverse? I mean, is it infinite? Is that what we're supposed to think? Does it matter? Natalie, you might be the best to answer that.
I mean, I don't think it matters to think about it because of how convoluted the language around those two things has become in the past, you know, 4 or 5 Marvel movies and shows. That's like, you can't pick one because they're the next thing. They're going to talk about the same thing, but they'll call it the other thing. At least that's what it feels like.
You know, we thought Loki was supposed to set up or at least really tie into multiverse stuff, but it's not quite. Like, the multiverse is different universes. This is different timelines. So Loki was slipping into the past and into the present and into the future, not into different timelines. Same stream of time. But no one could remember when he would go into the future because Kang was erasing the memories throughout the years. You don't see that happening, but you're supposed to understand that's happening.
I thought it was more like when he goes back in time and OB's remembering, like, because no one can move in time in the TVA until he did.
That's right.
He literally hadn't done it yet. I know that doesn't 100% make sense because it just doesn't really make sense, but that was how I read it.
Adam, or anyone, are there hints of Absalom here with Loki stuck in time and trying to undo things that were impossibly said already?
It's funny that you bring that up because when Natalie said, I just reached for my phone, that is the exact conversation that was happening while...
Can you replicate it?
Dear listener, we had a capital S, capital L, serious literature conversation going on in the group chat, and I'll be honest, I had a couple drinks at that point.
Oh, had you? Because it was a very fun conversation, and then there I was just laying in bed, I think, was all I was doing. No drinks involved.
No, it was, when I say a couple, I mean, it was literally like a drink and a half, and I watched the first like 90 seconds of Loki and thought, you know what? I'm not catching up with this. There's no way. This conversation about Faulkner and the intersections with Fitzgerald and Hemingway is more interesting than the screen.
You immediately hit that eject button.
I will say our conversation passed the phone test, ironically.
What is it, meaning you didn't check anything else but your phone?
Yeah, that show went by like it just flew by.
I kind of hate you missed it. I thought it was a very fun episode.
I'll probably try again. I genuinely need to. On a lot of the, because I really liked season one. I'm with y'all, I thought it was one of the better things that certainly the Marvel has done and probably Disney has done with these shows. But it got so complex by the end. And I realized that I had not even thought about it since the last episode of season one.
I think
it was just too much to catch up on in, you know, 30 seconds or whatever.
I think it's supposed to be. I don't think it's supposed to make a ton of sense. I think you're supposed to be very as confused as the characters are.
But honestly, the things that I remembered were just, you know, Owen Wilson palling around with Hiddleston more than anything else. And like, I mean, I know that's like enough to get me through, but when I saw other characters come on screen, I was like, oh yeah. And like, she, you know, cut the head off the god and did all of these things. And yeah, there's more going on here that I need to recall.
So Kang may be erasing people's memories and also in control of the entire TVA, which Loki exposes. Is Kang God?
No, he's FDR.
It is unsettling that the TVA is right across the river from us. I don't know what's happening here.
If you need any more TVA information, go listen to the Truckers. I think they cover all this Loki stuff.
Some time ago.
Kang also has a closer connection to Ravonna. The recording Loki decides to press play on, the recording is Kang and Ravonna. He's telling her how much of a marvel she is and how he admires her. It almost sounds like a love interest. That's probably going to be a plot point somehow. One thing we're supposed to notice is that Obi doesn't have his memory wiped. Everyone else is.
I'm confused about you when you're talking about, I didn't catch this memory wipe thing. What are you talking about?
So when Loki would come to the future, they didn't recognize him.
Who didn't recognize him?
Any of the people.
I thought that was just, that was the past.
Okay.
Because when he comes to the future, then Morbius is like, hey, where you been? You keep disappearing.
Huh.
But then he goes to the past, and obviously they don't know who he is, so why would they remember him?
Maybe I'm wrong, but I thought he did go to the future and they didn't recognize him, as if they something's happened to their brains.
I didn't catch that. Donovan, did you catch that?
Well, they never remembered him. So in the past, they hadn't met him yet.
Right.
So they didn't recognize him. But then in the present, they never remembered having met him in the past, except for Obi.
Right. But I don't know that they, for the few characters, because even Obi, it was like it's like if you just randomly had a memory that you had never thought about.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Obi was the only character that would have a reason to recollect that. Even though it was timeline silliness happening at the same time. Because it's a flat circle.
Okay, that makes sense too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, because why would you remember this random incident from 400 years ago?
But he does because he never sees anyone anyway.
I mean, honestly,
that would make sense.
And they're having a very specific conversation about a piece of material or a machine that nobody else would need until they show up again asking about it.
Maybe the future thing was when Morbius, he had written skin in the dust of the old computer, and then Loki, it's there in the future.
Right.
And they didn't recognize him there, or did they?
They didn't. He didn't interact with anybody, really, because it was like panic was happening.
Oh, it was empty.
Yeah.
It was empty. Okay. Okay, maybe I'm wrong about that. Interesting. We'll see how it plays out. One thing I don't understand, speaking of being a little confused, including that, I don't understand how killing the variant of Kang from last season, the one called He Who Remains, when Sylvie did that, how did that create all the havoc of the timelines branching out? Was that like a self-destruct mechanism kind of thing?
I think, if I remember correctly, and I may not, I think He Who Remains basically said, I'm keeping this under control. I'm keeping the rest of the Kangs out of this, and you do not want them to show up. And so when he is killed, then the others show up, I think.
That is also my understanding.
That would make sense. And they might have even put that in the preview, and I should have paid more attention. Anyway, that's all we have for the first episode. It's only one. They chose just the one episode. Sometimes they do two, but there are only going to be six total, so I suppose they're going to hang on to those on Thursday at 8 p.m., apparently. We're going to take a little break and check your timestamp, because we'll come back with some Wes Anderson talk. What makes the Alabama Take so special?
because it's our country. Because of all the great writing.
Is that all?
They also produce 6 podcasts.
6 podcasts? What are they?
Take It On Sports. Taking It Down. Check Your Shelf. This song sucks, yeah, baby. We are a Star Wars.
Do you listen to them?
Yes. I don't miss it.
Which one's your favorite?
I love all of them.
Okay, let us now shift to Netflix, where Wes Anderson's recent work of 4 short films based off some written work now streaming and were released in 4 consecutive days. 1 a day. For today, I think we're only going to talk about the first one. It's 39 minutes long. It's the longest of the 4. It is The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar. Stars Benedict Cumberbatch in the titular role and Ralph Fiennes as the author himself, though it seems like everybody kind of plays also minor roles a little later. They pop up. Donovan, am I covering everything here?
No, like, I think it's funny that Wes Anderson has been like, I kind of did this under protest because I didn't want to work with Netflix, but I wanted to work with Roald Dahl again. So that's not really thematically important, but I do find it funny.
Just now, when I opened Netflix, I realized when pulling this up that I've been conditioned to, much like when I hear the static in the arrival of HBO, I'm like, oh, good television is about to happen. Like, I can just a Rolodex of great theme songs rolls through my head. Now when I pull up Netflix, I'm like, you know what? Some bullshit is probably about to happen. Like, unless they have like an old TV show or movie that I want to watch, they just are not. It is a strange place for Wes Anderson to be releasing like a pet project.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's going to be weird to. It was weird to return to Netflix to.
For this. Especially because it just does not seem like Netflix's thing.
I do a lot of Netflix stand up comedy watching late at night, right before bed. But like for shows, their quality's dropped so badly.
Yeah.
From my understanding, viewers should really take the 4 films as a piece, but they can also, of course, turn to them separately. Perhaps next week we can discuss all 4 as a whole, because I think the other 3 run about 17 minutes each, give or take.
Yeah. And at least from the other 3, there is, and some of them, more of that, like, you know how Roald Dahl had like kind of an undercurrent of nastiness?
I don't know his history, which is...
There's more of that nastiness.
Yeah, important. His life as a person, not just an author, is kind of a subtext to some of this stuff.
Yeah, I think so. More his work.
What is his story? You know, there's some controversy surrounding him. What is he supposedly known for when it comes to his personal life that's not so good?
Oh, he didn't like the Jews.
Was that it?
That's one of the things.
That's not good.
Well, and even Wes Anderson has had to come out and like kind of, or he has been asked about the idea of making changes to any text, but specifically Dahl's text, and him saying, I think we kind of, it wasn't this exact phrase, but his the general vibes of Wes Anderson seems to be, we have to take it warts and all. And we certainly shouldn't change. You know, if there's a problem with this creator, we should just use it to learn about the context that it was created in and understand that it's a flawed person kind of argument. The New York Times had a good interview with him that was based around this specifically, around Sugar specifically.
You 3 are Wes Anderson devotees. What is it that draws you to him, fills you with joy when it comes to his work as a filmmaker and screenwriter?
I kind of remember like seeing the Royal Tenenbaums for the first time. And there's just scenes in there that's like, oh, wait, you can do it? Like, you're allowed to do that? And then pretty much every, he has some off ones, but kind of like every film is just him, like, either fiddling with or refining that feeling where it's like, you can create this world. And not only that, but, like, you can use this incredibly meticulously rendered world to comment on, in fact, real world issues, comment on them intelligently, in a way, obliquely yet intelligently, in a way that will kind of stick with you. I think his best stuff is about real stuff.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you talking about, he's like your first like indie band that you find in some ways for me, where I saw Royal Tenenbaums and Rushmore and it's like, oh, this is, you can do this. And I think Rushmore is incredibly hard on its sleeve and makes you feel, it feels more tethered to reality maybe than he's gotten more and more into like the dollhouse kind of setups. But, you know, I can think of moments in Royal Tenenbaums like Ben Stiller saying, I've had a really rough year, Dad, something like that. There's that line that parallels so well with moments towards the end of Grand Budapest, where characters, the guard and the dollhouse thing is kind of down and somebody has a real moment. And to me, putting that emotion inside that facade makes the emotion just explode. And I read a bit about Asteroid City. People were kind of divided on, and somebody said, you know, if you had never heard of Wes Anderson, or if it wasn't like almost a joke to take like a perfect, I'm having a brain fart, like a perfectly symmetrical picture and put it on Instagram and say, oh, listen, you know, if it wasn't like a meme at this point and you just saw that movie, you'd be like, oh my God, this is genius. What he did on like a close, it's like a play, but it's not a play. And he's playing with form and doing all these things, but it, because it's something that he's been doing and developing for decades at this point, we're kind of numb to the fact that it's good. And I'm not saying everything that he does is great, but it's almost like with Asteroid City and now with this, like the snake has caught its tail and become self-aware. Some of the choices that he made in Sugar to like have characters talk, some of the, again, referencing that Times article, he said, a thing he didn't want to lose was all of the, you know, reducing something to just a screenplay. Sometimes you just get dialogue or you have to project the setting or whatever, and you lose some of just the prose. So having characters speak that prose in addition to having like a play style setting. And he just keeps doing, I mean, he's not the first person to do this, but he does it pretty damn well.
I feel like he just keeps refining it and refining it too, right? Like, even with like Henry, which I liked quite a bit, but with Henry Sugar, it's like, oh, this is like, I just like took a hit of distilled Wes Anderson. Like, it's all here.
I mean, I think the only thing I would add, and this is a pretty simple take, I think, I just really like how he portrays relationships and how his characters talk to each other and interact with each other in a way that most people don't do that in film, but maybe in person, like in real life relationships. Yeah, brothers are going to yell at each other and do stupid things, and then they're going to forgive each other because they're brothers or whatever it may be. I just really like how he portrays relationships, even though they're often in these like silly, wacky scenarios. It's just, there's something very real underneath that you don't see, or I don't see very often.
Before we get deep into the short film, Henry Sugar, Adam, you talked about how it could be the case that Wes Anderson owes something to Fitzgerald and the Great Gatsby's sort of characters. You made a very tenuous connection there, but I thought it was an interesting one.
That's our Loki conversation. I'm not even, was I the one that suggested that?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
That you didn't say this, but I came to the conclusion that Wes Anderson should direct a version of The Great Gatsby.
It would definitely be a different one than the one that came out.
The Baz Luhrmann.
What if we made them work together on Great Gatsby?
I think that's like matter and antimatter. The universe would explode.
Right. Like something bad would happen for sure. No, the whole, Roald Dahl is probably a better thing for him to be working on, right? Than Fitzgerald, whose characters tend to be pretty, I think I remember in that text conversation and calling them a bit sloppy compared to Anderson characters who tend to be a little more stoic. And they make just catastrophes of their lives, but they do it in a pretty controlled way, whereas
sloppy and
Fitzgerald's character,
sloppy in their drunkenness, not in their the way that they're written. They're purposefully sloppy.
Of course, right. That the people that he creates very well are sloppy people, Fitzgerald, whereas Anderson, not as much.
If listeners are wondering why I'm asking you three about this, is I'm not necessarily a Wes Anderson devotee, although The Royal Tenenbaums is one of my favorite movies. Anything after that, I don't dig as much. I think his artifice just keeps me at arm's distance from anything that I'm supposed to take on a subtextual level or emotional level. And I just can't break through. But I appreciate and respect everything he does, which leads us to this one. The story is told as a frame story, another frame story, almost, I think that's correct. Ultra wealthy Henry Sugar finds a book about a man who studied under a yogi who taught him to see without his eyes. Literally. Well, maybe figuratively. We'll get to that. Sugar applies this and uses his skill to card read and gain more capital with gambling about London and in the world. Once he sees within himself a blood clot coming to kill him, stop his heart, I suppose, he decides that he should be giving the money away and even sets out to win more so that he can give more to charities and things. And so that's the setup of it. It's 39 minutes long. Love that for sure. It's a story about taking something that can be used as self-improvement in the spiritual, yet using it for the material until realizing you're mortal. And then that prompts you to become more benevolent.
I think I would slightly disagree with one thing in your recap, Blaine. Mm-hmm. So he does get killed by a blood clot at the end of his life. But the part where it's like, oh, and you know, like he could see himself and the blood clot's coming up. And it was like, that's what would have happened if this wasn't a true story. But this was a true story, so it didn't have a dramatic ending. He just woke up the next day and realized he wasn't satisfied with all his winnings and that he wanted to do something different. Because he had changed as a result of, what is he do, like concentrate on the candle for 5 years or whatever? It's something hilarious like that.
Okay.
Right. He does go peacefully, then he doesn't try to fight it in the end, but it wasn't like, I'm going to die soon, so I need to make a difference.
It wasn't? How did I misread that then? I thought that was the...
Because the author says, like, if this was not a true story, if it had to conform to dramatic, something dramatic would happen here and he would learn a lesson. But nothing dramatic happened. And I guess he learned a lesson.
Huh. He just had a genuine change of heart.
Yeah.
Okay. Or a moment of discovery, I suppose.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's worth talking about, too. I honestly thought it would be a deeper comment on the ultra wealthy, like those who have. And it briefly mentions this, and perhaps it is. You can talk about how you read the short film. I thought it would be a little bit more about those who have $75 million in the bank, but feel as though I've got to get $100 million. Why don't I have $100 million? Which is where Henry Sugar kind of is when he picks up the book.
I thought that, one, not to keep going back to the Fitzgerald thing, but you do with Anderson have to accept a certain level of it's wealthy people on screen. Sometimes it's because he needs them to have expendable income to do the things that he wants the story to do. And other times maybe it's time, they need leisure time to do the things. This was like a rich person's enlightenment though, right?
Well, I thought it was, I mean, I do agree with you and Donovan on that, but I do think, because wasn't it part of, you know, he goes in, he can now see the cards and he can win. So like the fun, that motivation of why, like there was no challenge anymore. So he had to find a new motivation.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, I totally agree with that too, right? Like he found that for various factors. He wanted something different.
So what did you make of it as a short film in and of itself? I think our analysis might change once we watch all four. And Donovan, you've watched two of them?
Mm-hmm. I've watched
and
two of
the
them.
Rest,
this one and then the rat catcher.
The rest of us have only watched this one, the Henry Sugar episode. What do you make of it as a short, as just a film?
It had a beginning, middle, and ending. What more can you ask for?
You liked it?
I did like it.
I did too.
It's funny, we were talking about Wes Anderson, and I realized something I didn't say, is that I still also find him pretty funny. Like, there were moments, like, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed almost the opposite of you, Blaine. Like, I kind of enjoyed the artifice of it. I enjoyed people talking directly to me. I enjoyed the way they said things, but I also thought, like, it's really funny. Like, there's a bit where, like, the Ben Kingsley character gets a, you know, pisses off the Yogi, so he throws a brick at him. And there's, like, all of Henry Sugar's disguises where Benedict Cumberbatch pulls out his easily his best American accent, the Texas drawl.
Pretty good.
But it was just, it was good, right? Like, it was, I didn't feel like I was like, oh, I need more. And I also didn't feel like that was so slight. That was too much.
It did seem well-paced to me. It gave me enough of each part of that beginning, middle, and end to walk away happy and didn't seem to like belabor any points. You do have to accept, again, that your takeaway is that a rich person had a change of heart for the good. I don't know what, maybe it gets complicated about like Western people learning how to meditate from a yogi and starting to profit from it. Probably, maybe not a story that someone would write now, but I saw a few things that said, man, Wes Anderson must have been just flying a mile high when he found the Roald Dahl had a story about Westerners fascinated with Indian culture. Art imitating life. But yeah, I mean, it seemed to, I don't know. There are always moments in him with him where I'm like, is he going to finally lose me with, you know, even little things like when the yogi levitates while he's meditating and the actor just turned the box that he was sitting on. It's like, he's winking so hard at the camera right now. This is finally when I'm going to, in return, roll my eyes and turn this off. But I think he pushed it so far that it came full circle to be enjoyable.
He's a master of pushing it. Like, even like which I didn't talk about on this podcast, but I adored Asteroid City, and I could not tell you why I think it's the best movie I've seen this year, but I do. But like, there's so much of that where he pushes it and he pushes it and he pushes it, but it, like, somehow he usually sticks the landing.
Natalie, were you ready to turn it off at any point during our viewing?
No, honestly, I thought, and maybe it was because of the length of it or what, I don't know what it was, but after it was over, I thought about how interesting this would have been if you were in like a high school English class and your teacher rolled in the AV cart and this is what they played for 45 minutes to fill the class. Like, if you had a sub that day, what that would have done to a young Natalie. It would have just been, I don't know. I just thought, I really liked that. I thought it was great. Lots to say about it.
Something else just about, I guess it's kind of the mechanics of it, but one thing I like about Wes Anderson at this stage in his career is that he can work with whoever he damn well pleases.
But he still chooses the same 10 people.
He's got his repertoire. I say he's got his repertoire players. He's got his repertoire players, right? Like Ralph Fiennes at this point. I don't think he's ever used like Richard, I'm going to say his last name wrong. I apologize. Iowodi before. That was fun to see him. And it's just like he can just get anyone to do whatever. Dev Patel was awesome as the other doctor.
The New York Times interview, he said, I've been trying to get him for some time. And the interviewer says, for what roles? And he said, well, I can't tell you that because then the person who ended up getting the job would know. Good to see him join the crew. Mm-hmm.
He even got Ben Kingsley in there. That was great.
Which was just, I don't think that I attempted to read anything about it going in, and him popping up was a very pleasant surprise.
Absolutely. Also, I'll just keep returning to like these, there's something about like the dialogue that he delivers is very artificial. There's something rapid fire about it, but these actors are good enough that they really handle it. And it's not annoying or, well, for me at least, it doesn't read as annoying or contrived. It reads of a piece with the whole thing. The thing is kind of in union with itself.
Well, Ralph Fiennes and Ben Kingsley are like the perfect people to do that too. And for me to just completely accept the gravity of them as artists is carrying whatever words they're going to say.
And even just like, I love scenes where like Ralph Fiennes gets to, like he gets to be the kind of puttering around the cottage artist or author. And he gets to be the perturbed policeman who calls Henry Sugar an idiot for throwing money into the street instead of endowing charities.
The tackling of a specific kind of language reminds me a lot of David Milch. He had to have some specific actors in order to tackle that language, especially of Deadwood. It also reminds me a little of David Lynch. Of course, he's also famous for using the same 15 actors, but that he also probably knows that they can handle his dialogue.
And I think that's a really interesting connection with David Lynch, Blaine, because I do think that, you know, we see, in like, especially like in Twin Peaks, but we see that he has this like kind of fascination with like middle American artifice, right? Like even in like the first season of Twin Peaks, right? Like the high school is practically, like they're practically Bobby Soxers. Mm-hmm. And then it all gets much sadder and grimmer. But, you know, like there is that, there's, you know, even silly things, right? Like in the return, right? Like the arm wrestling competition. It's great, it's scary, but it's also like it's fascinated with like nobody thinks anyone in real life would ever do that. But it's able to take itself so seriously and yet not seriously at all at the same time.
Yeah, there's so much to be said about creating a image on screen that's completely fucking fake. Just mm-hmm. There's no realism to it, but the emotion or the words or both are just touching in on something you haven't thought about in a long time.
I think at this stage in the game, too, two other similarities I would possibly point out is David Lynch, at least in this stage of his career, he's pretty much in control of everything, right? Like, sometimes he doesn't have enough time, sometimes he doesn't have enough money, but he's gonna tinker and get, you know, everything kind of the way he wants it, just like Wes Anderson. They sort of have that unity of vision. And also, it just seems like they're freaking great to work with. Like, the actors that work with them just love working with them and give better performances because of that.
They definitely keep coming back.
Mm-hmm.
There was a moment, or a quote from, I hate to keep referencing that New York Times interview, but he said how much he still loves being on set and all the things that a director has to do, and have we blocked this the right way? Is everybody in place? Is the staff right for today? You know, doing all the, who's going to get lunch? All these things that are just like the mundane aspects of what most people would think of as a glamorous life and how that can drag you down. But then they say action, and because he has those set piece kind of theater productions, he says for 90 seconds we watched part of a movie. Like, he's still like enamored with the fact that after this they're going to all take menus and order lunch, but right now I am watching 90 seconds of what will be a movie.
I love that.
I thought that was really, I love, and I think Lynch is the same way. They're still charmed by the fact that they're making art and feel like it's a privilege.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a follow-up question. Could Kyle MacLachlan enter the Wes Anderson Players Club?
100%.
I was going to say 100%. Natalie, what do you think?
I don't know that I want him to.
I don't want him to. I'm just asking.
He could.
I'd love to see what he could do on the right role, because I think that Anderson is one of those directors who've either very rarely or doesn't at all miscast people.
Tom Hanks
is perfect for their role.
Tom Hanks joining the universe of Wes Anderson was kind of shocked me. I haven't seen it yet, but I thought that casting was a surprise. I didn't see it coming.
It really worked for me because Tom Hanks could be the star of that movie, and he is just kind of in a side player, somewhat funny, somewhat sad role, and he's great. Like, he's honestly great in it. Like, I didn't know how that was going to turn out, but he's incredible.
I think I said it on here, but I kept forgetting that he wasn't Bill Murray.
Yeah. Say that.
Those are our thoughts on the first installment of Wes Anderson's 4 short pieces of work for Netflix. Well, we're going to come back to this next week after having watched all 4 rather than just the first. We're also going to talk maybe Loki second episode if it warrants. We'll also talk about some of The Fall of the House of Usher. Probably the first 2 or 3 episodes is where we'll go with it. That sounds like a show. We'll have an extra conversation or two for the YouTube viewers. Just remember, if you go to the Alabama Take on YouTube, you can listen to all the podcasts. You can listen to our podcast or choose the video version and watch with some extra stuff. Hope you do that and hope you enjoy. We're going to make sure those timestamps are working for you. So we're at the end of our episode. It's not the end of our conversation. Find Taking It Down Pod on Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, and TikTok. And then for all things Alabama Take related, go to the Alabama Take on social media. Follow those. If you're watching our video version, you get yourself a t-shirt like Natalie's sporting. She's got the Alabama Take t-shirt, although there are a lot. You go to shop on thealabamatake.com. Tell you what, if you're on Apple Podcasts, go to Taking It Down. Scroll all the way down. Leave us some stars. Write us a review. Here you go. I'll give you a prompt. Who's your favorite host?
Oh, I don't want to know.
I do.
Who's your favorite host? Write that in your review. If you're curious, like if you never know, what can I write as a review? Just say, Natalie's the best because she keeps everyone in line. Because she shuts up the stupidity. We'll be back next week with The Fall of the House of Usher, the rest of the Wes Anderson films, maybe Loki, maybe Wrexham. We will see. Talk to everyone later. Thanks for joining us.